Welcome to Lawmen, a podcast about local legends and obscure curiosities from days of yore. I'm Alistair Beckett King.
And I'm James Shakeshaft.
And in this episode, we're joined by comedian, podcaster, and self-proclaimed beatnik Robin Ince.
Yes.
For a psychogeographical tour of
The Chilterns.
The Chilterns. Which sounds like a sitcom.
It could be a new one, The Chilltown.
Oh, cool. The young people will enjoy that joke, James.
What, the ones that don't listen?
Shut up!
Shut up, they'll hear us.
With their pin-sharp hearing that young people have.
I broadcast this at the mosquito pitch to keep youths away from my house.
It's the story of Grimm's Ditch.
One of the Grimm's Ditches. There's more than one.
Hello, James Shakeshaft.
Oh, hi, Alistair Beckett King.
I love the surprise in your voice there.
I know.
Very sort of afternoon special. Oh, hello there.
Oh, hello, Alistair Beckett King. You've come to see me in my shed.
Yes. Do me a favour, James. What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to stand up, walk out of the shed, and you should see a little grotto in front of you. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, now just walk north into the grotto.
Yes.
Okay, and on the floor you should see a knapsack in front of you. Have you got it?
Yeah.
Yep, so...
What appears to be an out-of-work actor dressed as a jester here. Shall I just ignore him?
Yep, try not to be distracted by that.
Certainly.
And don't step on the blue tiles.
Okay.
Inside the knapsack,
yep.
You should find an obsidian mirror. Can you see that?
I don't know what obsidian means.
It's not important. It's a black volcanic rock.
Okay.
What happens is... I mean, I shouldn't have to go into this, James, but what happens is... When magma cools very quickly,
mm-hmm.
The crystals don't have time to form.
Go on.
And so you get a very smooth glass-like rock.
Right. Okay.
So that's what obsidian is. And it's used in scrying mirrors and that sort of thing.
I don't know what scrying is either.
All right. Well, look, I'm just trying to introduce the guests and you're making it very difficult. Look into the mirror, James.
I'm making it difficult. You've built a grotto in my garden that contains an obsidian mirror.
I've done my bit.
That's crying.
Obsidian?
Obsidian.
Look in the mirror, James.
Oh, it's like when your phone runs out of batteries.
There's a guest law person in the mirror. Can you see the guest law person?
Oh, yeah, I'm making him out now. It's the fairest in the land.
It's the incredibly patient Robin Ince, who's remained silent during all of that absolute piffle. Hello, Robin. Thank you for being a guest law person.
What I loved about that was when you did that, knowing, obviously, that I'm overly verbose, that the fact that you said, we're doing an intro, don't worry, it won't take long, because you could already see, oh, God, is he going to be able to be bloody quiet for 1 minute and 12 seconds? I'm entirely uncertain. Whether that's possible.
I'm in the mirror. Drone.
Tap, tap, tap.
I was worried you were going to jump in and correct my explanation of how obsidian forms.
Oh,
no,
don't worry about that. I've got a man who does all my science for me. So I let him do all that.
I'm sure the geologists on Twitter will be all over me.
Oh, no, not geology Twitter. That's the worst kind.
We did an Infinite Monkey Cage, the Radio 4 show I do. We did one on geology. And when the two geologists talked about the fact that sometimes you just chew on a rock to get a sense of what the rock is.
What?
The audience found it hilarious. And they were going, no, you really do. There's a way, I mean, you don't chew hard. I mean, especially not if you're 52 like me. You know, I can't even have one of those little eclair toffees, let alone a piece of obsidian or anything else. But it is, but there's just a, so you kind of just play with it in your mouth and you will get a sense of what form of rock it is.
Oh.
It's obviously 100% accurate, but it will manage to narrow down to some extent.
Mm. If you're in a sort of a cat-heavy area, you find out that's not a rock.
Oh, yeah, never. I mean, if you're actually buying cat litter and you want to know the quality of the cat litter, that's a disaster.
Certainly not used cat litter.
I think Gwyneth Paltrow recommends it for something or other. I think you're meant to pull warm cat litter up your bottom or something and it's maybe good for halitosis. I don't know.
But if you are chewing cat litter, there's no better way of getting a sense of the absorbency.
This is low dusting.
I think if John Waters did the Home Shopping Channel, there would be a bit where the ghost of Divine would appear.
I just watched that. The
Pink Flamingos.
I'm thinking of the...
The Shopping Channel?
Shopping Channel. QVC, that's the one.
Just
very
that.
Disturbing. Disturbing, outlandish, garish, but...
Inexpensive.
It really challenged what I thought about a lot of things. Yeah, amazing.
But I have a great pen. If anyone needs any cans pierced, I'm your guy.
I'm confident that the listeners to our folklore podcast will be familiar with your Infinite Monkey Cage output. and the cosmic, you are like the overlord of the cosmic shambles network.
Yeah, that is where I reign in my mystical land, yeah. Which is so much, I mean, it's one of those things which I'm sure as you found as well during lockdown, trying to just create things, because if you don't create things, that's all we are. That's all we are, isn't it? We turn up to gigs or we make something, we film something stupid. It doesn't really matter. The audience are secondary, useful should they wish to pay us. But the main thing is that I think it's an interesting division that you see in times like this of just how much some people creating is a very, very necessary part of their existence. It's not in any way a game plan for a job.
Mm.
It is, and I think it's an act of kind of trepanning, I always think, you know, which is, you know, even though I know trepanning probably actually wasn't about getting out the bad thoughts, and there's a lot of new evidence about trepanning and what it actually is, but using the traditional sense that trepanning was, I will drill a hole in my head and all the devils are coming out.
I think you're right. I think there's a sense in which we're trees in the woods looking around and going, well, there's nobody here, but I'm going to fall anyway, because that's my thing. I might as well do it.
I mean, that's what I love about the Cosmic Shambles Theory. It's an excuse to have conversations with people who just have, you know, knowledge which is way beyond me. And I think that's why I'm lucky about ending up doing stuff in science as well, is I've, you know, to have on kind of quick dials and go, I don't seem to understand black holes today and the idea that we might all merely be holograms. Hang on a minute, I've got someone's number in my phone. I think they've studied that.
Which I guess is why we've come to you as the Metatron of all knowledge.
The cosmic Shoggoth.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you grew up on the cusp of Hertfordshire and Buckingham. I'm from the northeast of England, so all of these places are just meaningless, noddy towns to me. Where are you from, Robin?
Well, it is. I mean, the thing that makes it easier is it is the kind of place where Midsummer Murders is filmed a lot.
Yes.
So it's not far from Great Missenden, I think, which is, I think it's also where Roald Dahl had his house. I think it was Missenden.
There's a small museum there, I believe.
So I'm not far from there. That was where I was born. Sometimes I've been touring. I remember being in Brisbane and turning on a TV at like 11 at night in the hotel and going, oh, that's where I was born, because it was a Midsummer Murders. Where there'd been some kind of rivalry over a herbaceous border that had led to, you know, canny use of a scythe. It's just on that kind of border, just around the Chiltern Hills. Dirty Dozen was filmed here.
The Dirty Dozen?
Yeah, The Dirty Dozen with Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine. I have, I possess some quite poor quality photos of the backs of their heads in a Jeep.
Whoa.
Dirty Dozen was filmed before I was born, but apparently my sister, who would have been five, did have her picture taken with Lee Marvin, but no one knows where that picture is. That is one of the great... One of the great folkloric traditions of the Chiltern Hills area is those who apparently met Lee Marvin, and yet there is no evidence for it.
It was said that Lee Marvin could be seen, but never the front of his face. The back. Whoever saw his face would die the very next day.
What's that rumbling noise in the distance? Is it Marvin's Jeep? Yes.
This is the home counties. So this, I suppose this is not that far from your area, is it, James?
We're just the other side of the Chiltern Ridge, where the rest of Midsummer Murders is shot. Tame, where the high street is the high street of Midsummer.
Is there a big east side, west side rivalry?
I don't know. We've definitely got a Midsummer walking tour, and I think you can see the area where Michelle McCutcheon was crushed by a cheese that time.
And let's be clear, that is the plot and not a production accident.
Yes.
That you're making light of there. I don't. Do I need to explain what Midsummer Murders is in case non-British listeners aren't aware?
It's a worldwide phenomenon. I genuinely can tell you, from being someone who watches television at, you know, kind of midnight in various different places in the world. Eddie Pepitone, do you know Eddie?
Yeah, I know of Eddie, certainly.
Wonderful American comic, and I highly recommend, if anyone listening to this has not seen the documentary, The Bitter Buddha is a brilliant movie about him, and very, very, very funny comedian. And he and his wife in LA, they just sit and they watch British murder mysteries the whole time.
Really?
So while we feel the exotica of Columbo on Channel 5, he feels the exotica of... Lewis, unfortunately, is a no-go area now, which is... Yeah. I just can't watch it now because of that silly man being silly.
Mm.
Kevin Whateley. No, he seems like a decent guy.
I think he is. I'm pretty certain. I've met him a couple of times and he's all right.
Yep.
Whateley's all right.
Yep.
The balance of the universe, in fact, the all rightness of Whateley is so great due to the unall rightness.
Yes. And of course, neither of them could exist without the other.
No.
It's like the Dark Crystal. Ah. Only one of them looks like a grotesque puppet, so that's unfair to Kevin Whateley.
I did do a little bit of folkloric research on this area. Do you know the river the Misbourne?
Yeah.
It goes through Missenden. It's apparently at points the river goes underground, yes. And then when it rises up and when it's in flood, that's said to be a bad omen. According to Forgotten Folklore of the English Counties, which is collected by Ruth L. Tongue, and L is her middle initial. She's not like a Spanish wit.
It's a bit of a stretch to say that a flood is a bad omen. Like you could say that about any natural disaster, like an earthquake's happening, you're like, oh, bad omen. It's like, no, it's just a bad thing currently happening, isn't it?
It tends to foretell houses falling down, these earthquakes. This river has predicted the Fire of London, the Plague of London, the death of King Edward VII, and the First World War. And this was reported in 1939 when the river was in flood, and the person to whom the thing was told rode home after a long day, stabled their tired pony, and the sirens began their first eerie warning wail for the first blitz.
Mm.
Yeah.
It does say a lot, doesn't it, about that kind of patriarchal and reasonably, I suppose, oppressive society that existed, that the availability of water was seen as a curse rather than... Because as you said, it's not even flooding. It's literally, if the river can be seen, if water is available and therefore the market for water that is sold by your local lord is destroyed, it's a bad omen. Mm. It's a bad omen for the markets.
My understanding is that you know some creepy stuff has happened down your manor.
I mean, one of the things that's very beautiful here is the local manor house, which also, for fans of The Crown, doubled up as Churchill's House Chartwell. Oh. There's a one of those, you know, when you see an oak tree or a large tree that you cannot believe it's still alive because so much of it, it's this incredible hollow, so the whole of the centre is gone. It's a very, I would say it is probably, for an average adult human, it's probably about 1.5 arm spans in terms of the girth of the trunk. And that was apparently where... when Queen Elizabeth first visited the manor house, she hid in that tree, and jewels were hidden there.
Oh.
Or indeed, her jewels merely fell off.
I heard that she lost her jewels within,
why was she hiding?
Within that oak.
Do you know what? Back in the old days, there were a lot of oak trees. The Virgin Queen, I'll tell you what, I don't know an oak tree where she didn't lose her jewels.
For the listener's benefit, you took a little sip of tea there after that one.
Black coffee, mate. I'm a beatnik, okay?
I beg your pardon.
You don't read this much Kerouac and have tea at this time of day. But yeah, so it's got, and also there are lots of things, like there's a series of what are kind of considered to be passages where monks would have hidden during the Reformation.
Oh, we love a monk's tunnel.
I love a priest hole or a monk's tunnel.
Yeah, and they're great. There's a few of those, though apparently my dad, sometimes this manor house is now actually open to the public, but it used to only be open on very special occasions. If the Sealed Knot came, for instance, to reenact the Battle of Naseby or similar.
Ooh.
And the Sealed Knot, by the way, because I think that is, though Midsummer Murders travels, I would imagine anyone listening in, say, Idaho will not know about the rich tradition of battle reenactment in the UK.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, really?
They'd know about battle reenactments, but probably not the tradition of reenacting civil wars.
Yeah.
Came from over here.
Yeah, well, I suppose because they haven't yet reached the point where they're distant enough away from a civil war to actually start reenacting it. It does feel it's being lived.
It feels like in America there's a real risk that a reenactment of the Civil War could just start a new Civil War at the moment, and it's probably just not worth the trouble. We all enjoy costumes, but come on.
Just a bit of cosplay.
But my dad, when he would sometimes be asked to volunteer to take people around the priest holes, would explain that they were mainly actually sewage. Some monks did have to hide there, but they weren't hiding in apparently purpose-built priest holes. They were making use of the sanitary equipment that could fit a man and his Hessian.
So there's a sort of a teleological error that we've assumed design in seeing a priest in a hole. We've assumed that the hole was made for the priest rather than that the priest has simply made use of a pre-existing hole.
I'm glad I've done this, because I've never thought of it from a teleological perspective, but it's quite clear, you're right. So yeah, that's the kind of thing that's... And the house that I was brought up in was built on the site of an old inn, the Goat Inn. Mm. So when I was a kid, I would have the great excitement if you went digging in the garden, you'd find lots of bits of clay pipes, as I'm sure people have enjoyed that kind of thing. So it's that... There's nothing, though, in terms... Apart from the fact that the Peter Cushing film Trial by Combat was made here, which is a Peter Cushing film which very few people have seen. Mm. Very similar to George A. Romero's Night Riders, which is a George A. Romero film that's very rarely seen. It turns out that actual battle reenactment movies are not very popular. I don't know if you've seen either. Have you seen Night Riders?
I have not, James.
If it's got nothing to do with the David Hasselhoff TV series, then no.
No, Night Rides is about... Ed Harris is in it, quite an early outing for Ed Harris. And it's about a bunch of people, and as Tom Savini as well, the makeup artist for George A. Romero as well, who acted in stuff as well. And they go around from town to town doing kind of various things with lances and all of that stuff, but on motorbikes. Oh. So they're kind of medieval knights, but on motorbikes in the 20th century. And Trial by Combat, the Peter Cushing movie, has a similar thing, but obviously without the motorbikes, because British film industry did not have that kind of budget in 1976.
But if you want to see a guy on a tricycle with a lance, that's the film.
We haven't got a lance, but we have got a little bell. So this fight scene is, it's not so much a fight scene now, it's you just going around the circle here in this farmyard ringing the bell.
But at each other.
Yeah. One of you has tinnitus. It's actually, there's a lot of jeopardy. There's a lot of jeopardy here.
Mm.
The manor house you mentioned, is that Cheney's Manor? Is that the name of it?
Cheney's Manor House, yeah.
You didn't say the name. You're trying to keep the village a secret. Would you rather I didn't broadcast the name?
No. It's far too late for that now. I mean, it was. Okay. There used to be a mist around it, and we called it Luffville, which of course was an anagram for Ghoulville. And I will throw in any chance where I can use a reference to the Monster Club. Any of you seen the Monster Club?
I don't think so.
Right. I know this is not technically an obscure niche 1970s culture show, but I would like to apologise. Anything I appear on will eventually become that. The Monster Club is the first film that I ever saw from a video rental shop. Ooh. It's Vincent Price and John Carradine and James Lawrenson, who is a brilliant actor, who's in Waiting for Godot. And it's about the club where the monsters hang out. And Vincent Price tells three stories, three terrifying stories. Stories. One about the Shadmock. The Shadmock, which whistles, has a very powerful whistle.
Oh, I had a mate like that.
Yeah. Well, this one's not an annoying whistle. This is a whistle that kills. It's a very different thing.
Which is a little annoying.
Yeah.
More than annoying to be killed by a whistle.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's more than annoying.
Mm. Yeah.
There's a whistle that gets on your nerves. There's another that actually eats into and ultimately melts all your physical structure.
I had a mate like that.
Is that the tagline for the film?
Yeah. Let me tell you about a whistle. Are you sure this is going to sell? We'll have a picture of the whistle on the poster and everything. Sorry, I can't remember what you asked me at the beginning of the show, and this has really not gone into any direction that's usable. For you.
Just wondered if you were recording.
I'll delete it now, shall I? Yeah, it's probably for the best, isn't it? I think eventually there's going to be a podcast I do where someone will finally go, I've been listening. Can I diagnose you now? Can I?
You're listening to What's Wrong with Robin Ince. I think I asked you about Cheney's Manor.
Oh, yeah, the Manor House, right. So, yeah.
Cheney's Manor, or as I believe it used to be called, Cheney's Palace. Which is quite exciting, even though there is no person called Cheney's, because Cheney's is the name of the village.
Originally Eisenhamstead, or Iron Homestead.
Ooh.
There we are. That's
And
it has
nice.
A very beautiful church, St. Michael's, which has the Bedford Chapel. So the Bedford family, the Russell family, who Bertrand Russell, sadly, who's the Russell member of the Russell family, I know, was not buried here, but most of the Bedfords were, who are now at Woburn Abbey. And I believe that in the Bedford Chapel, one of the people who's buried there was beheaded and then pardoned, and so their head was then sewn back on.
In looking into Cheney's Manor, I found a fantastic mm-hmm. book. So in the mid-1950s, the Duke of Bedford, his family by then no longer lived in Cheney's Manor, but they had. And he was, my understanding is that according to the book, that the Duke himself was basically penniless. Now, I don't know what the Duke version of being basically penniless is, but there's a little sort of about the author thing where it tries to win you over to the Duke. And it says how he had to go off to South Africa and become a fruit farmer. Because what could endear you more to a white British aristocrat than having been a farmer in apartheid South Africa? What hardship he must have undergone. But the book itself, I really like the cover. So,
Silver-plated spoon, yeah.
Both of these covers to A Silver-Plated Spoon, which I hope we will be able to tweet out, fill me with enormous delight.
Yeah.
Especially the caption on one of them, an enterprising young duke. I mean, if you look at the picture of him, young is a stretch. And I think enterprising is also a stretch.
Yeah, but you also know that young thing. You must sometimes watch Talking Pictures TV or something like that, and you see some actors who are all in their late 50s, and then you look them up on IMDb and go, wow, they were all 24 years old. There is something very interesting. Genetics doesn't really seem to have found out yet. But then also then they stay at that age. So there's a kind of point of adulthood turning directly into middle age, but they're not really passing beyond that either.
Mm. Is it meant to be sort of a bad thing that rather than having a silver spoon, he's only got a silver-plated spoon?
He only got a silver-plated spoon,
oh,
yeah.
Gutted for you, mate. We didn't even have a spoon.
Yeah.
We had to share it.
But he tells the story of the Rye House plot, which is where you got the beheaded William Russell, who is in the fabulous mausoleum. The Encyclopedia Britannica refers to the Rye House plot as an alleged plot, which is really hedging their bets for something that happened in the 17th century, I think.
Well, do you know what? Yeah, libel laws when that was put together. I don't think that passage in the Encyclopedia Britannica has actually been updated since 1814. So that would be some things. People go, things have changed. You know what? We have to change the chapter about how sawdust ultimately creates mice babies. Whereas, yeah, I think some things are unchanging and therefore left untampered with.
To be fair, he did have his head sewn back on. So perhaps it was an alleged plot.
Maybe this is it. Supposedly, a group of nobles, including William Russell of Professor Yaffle heritage, ancestor of the cartoon bird, Professor Yaffle.
Yeah,
he and others plotted that when Charles II was riding past Rye House, he was to be executed. But that didn't happen.
How are they going to do it? The old wire. The old cheese wire across.
I don't know. I don't know what the plan was.
Shove him. Give him a shove.
Alleged plan was, obviously. And they were found out, and he was beheaded, but his head was sewn back on, and now he, head and all, are buried in the tomb. Is meant to be one of the finest in England.
It's very. I've never actually been into the chapel. It's opened very rarely. You can get into the, or you used to be able to get into the main church.
There's that sheet of flames that comes up every time you try and go in as well, isn't
there? Yeah.
You need the gold key, James. Have you not found the gold key yet?
But yeah, it's very beautiful. So it's and I always used to excite me as a child to think that there was someone beheaded who would then. I mean, I presume now sewn back on, that won't have made any difference because
I don't know.
Whatever was
you and your rationalism, you and your pessimistic skepticism, have a dream for once, Robin.
Well, I don't know what the medical world was at the time. I don't think it would have cured it.
Yeah,
is it called reheading? By the way,
recapitation. I think is the technical term. And Cheney's manor is supposedly haunted, but this shocked me. I can't find a single corroborated account of the haunting there.
What?
One tour guide has a long passage about the house and ends by saying that the attic is all one open floor full of ghosts. And that's all the information. It's just full of ghosts.
It's known for having some of the laziest ghosts. That's the thing. What used to draw people there was its incredible laziness.
Not very far away from you is Grimm's Ditch, also known as Grimm's Dyke, also known as Graham's Dyke. Not as good. Much, much worse a name.
Mm.
And there are a lot of Grimm's Dykes. James, you told me there's a Grimm's Ditch near you.
Yeah, there's one. We've got a little bit of something called Grimm's Ditch. It seems that's something that cropped up all around the country.
Yeah. According to the book Records of Buckinghamshire, 1858, which I daren't ask Robin if he's read, because he probably has.
I haven't. I'm quite excited by this.
It's a catalogue of the landscape and antiquities of Buckinghamshire. Grimm's Dyke, it's called both ditch and dyke, and of course it is both. It's a ditch and then it's a dyke, depending on which side you're approaching it from. And it's still there, it's not that deep, but it goes on for quite a long way. And according to the book in 1858, even at that time, the country folk of the region believed it to stretch all the way around the world, which I thought seemed a little bit fanciful. But then thinking about how flat earthers still exist now, I suppose it is plausible that you could find one person in Buckinghamshire who thought that.
Who just couldn't be bothered to go all the way along.
Who just couldn't be bothered to check if anything was on the other side of the dyke.
Probably around the world or something. I'm going back to bed.
Records of Buckinghamshire says that Grimm's Dyke is believed to have been executed by Lollius Urbicus.
Lollius?
Yes, he was one of the most amusing Roman generals, son of Rophlius Urbicus and Lamauius Urbicus. We all remember them.
There was their annoying cousin, IIRC.
Apart from Lollicus, the other person who is credited with having built it was, of course, the magician Guy de Gravade, or Guy de Gravard of Tring.
Oh, yeah.
And I have to say, just over the border in Hertfordshire, there's some fantastic names. We've got Gubblecoat, Bull Beggar's Lane.
I know that very, very well.
A bull beggar is one of the oldest names for a type of fairy. Watford.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing names. The book records that they believed the Great Dyke was more than a match for the sea, and like the sea serpent, drags its length along beneath the surface. And the name Grimm's Dyke, it might have been named after a Graham, but the connection made by this book is the, apparently, Saxon word for magician, Grimmer, which also sometimes means devil. The writer says, we may fairly interpret Grimm's Dyke as the ditch of the wizard.
Mm.
And from this point on, basically everything about it sounds like a prog rock album. It's a weird or wizard spot, and upon its bank nothing of good omen happens. I've been told in perfect good faith by one who dwelt near it that on Grimm's Dyke the unhappy Jane Shore perished, being starved to death by King Richard's order. Now, Jane Shore was the mistress of Edward IV, who fell out of favour. And you know that thing in Game of Thrones where one of the ladies had to walk around naked? I haven't seen it. Do you know the scene I mean?
I've not seen it.
I've not seen it.
Are we the three people who haven't seen Game of Thrones? Jane Shore was the inspiration for, I think, Cersei Lannister. Apologies, listeners. Being humiliated, she was forced to walk the streets of London wearing only a shift or something like that. And the story is, people were forbidden to help her, and her baker, who gave her a penny loaf or a halfpenny loaf, was executed for having given her that loaf upon Grimm's Dyke. Although I've checked, and that happens in a play called The Tragedy of Jane Shore by Nicholas Rowe, 1714, and not in what we would usually think of as reality.
I was thinking that because Graham's Dyke is kind of the antithesis, because sometimes finding out that Grimm's Dyke might be Graham's Dyke is the opposite of Bun Hill. Because Bun Hill, you go, oh, Bun Hill, what a fun name, Bun Hill, Bun Hill. Oh, it's Bone Hill. Oh, it's the Hill of Bones for the destitute and lost. All these mixed messages.
So, now to the scores. Yes. Are you ready to score this? I was about to use the word ramshackle, but it's negative. This somewhat meandering episode of Lawmen. Okay, our first category is naming.
Naming, okay.
What do you think of the names?
Well, I love Grimm's Ditch.
Graham's Ditch.
But I less like Graham's Ditch.
Okay, but
I like the Devil. It's also the Devil's Ditch or the Devil's Dyke as well.
Yes.
But I don't think the Devil's ever been called Graham. The silliest name I heard for the Devil was Roger recently.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Roger's Storms or something. Tornadoes were called something like Roger Storms because you didn't really want to say the Devil's name.
So you said Roger instead.
So they called him Roger. I don't think he's ever been called Graham, though.
Well, there used to be a cereal called Golden Lucifers. And then they changed it. So I think there was...
I prefer Choco Beelzebubs.
We've got the village of Tring. Come on. Gubblecoat, Bull Beggar's Lane, Guy de Gravard, the alchemist.
His mate, I think his mate's John Bond as well. He had a sidekick called John Bond. And they vanished a house, which sometimes appears as a ghost.
Oh.
Our first ghost house of the podcast.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, it's strong on naming. And of course, we've got every British actor from the 1970s.
Every male British actor from the 1970s. Because they didn't have women in films in those days. There would usually be one, but that was considered the limit.
That's what the posters used to say. They used to say, Vincent Price, Nikki Henson, a woman. That was it.
I'm going to go with... A four.
A four out of five?
Because I like Grimm's Ditch. It's got a good feel to it.
Nice. Okay, I'll pop that in the ledger. Thank you very much. I'll just inscribe
Thank
that in on the vellum. The second category that we're pitching towards you is supernatural.
Ooh.
A ditch, James. Explain that.
That might have been made by a wizard or Graham. I'm going to go three because we've basically got...
What?
We've got a devil or wizard called Graham. And there was an attic full of ghosts. So you're going to get just a three as a job lot for your attic full of ghosts. Your open plan ghost house.
There's also, let's not forget, the beheaded, decapitated, and that haunting possibility.
That sounds like pure science
to
me.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Three, that is completely unreasonable. But we haven't time to complain. So, because for the sake of the listener, we're a little over time. Next category is... The Postgate Always Rings Twice.
Which is?
AKA 70s Oddities and Miscellanea.
Well.
Now, come on, James.
I mean, if I could give you 70 out of 5, it would definitely be the score. I think...
This reminds me very much of the Iron Cloak from 1976 with Steve Trousers. Have you seen that?
No.
It's a classic. Steve Trousers, John Trousers, no relation, and a woman.
Oh, woman out of the Vincent Price films.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, yes, you have seen it. Yeah,
yeah, it's got to be five. It's got to be full marks.
Fantastic.
It's a whiz bang.
And our final category, recapitation.
Oh, yes. How many times did it happen?
Oh, come on, James. It happened once.
No, no. He was fully recapitated. I'll give you a four, but I'll take that little extra one, and I'm going to screw it back on. I'm pretty sure that's how they did it. Like a bottle of matey. For American listeners, Google it.
For American listeners, you're on your own.
Yeah, soz.
Robin Ince, thank you so much for being a deputy law person. It's been wonderful to have you on the pod. We've wanted this for such a long time, and COVID got in the way.
And now regretting it for even longer afterwards, which I think is good.
Absolute nightmare come the edit, but recording it was a delight, editing it.
Oh, if you want to do, look, if you want me to, I can come back, I can script everything I've said. I can, I'm sure we can work an in and out that will work. I'm so sorry.
No, this has been wonderful. I don't think we have time for you to plug everything you're up to, but I understand that you've just finished writing a book. Is there anything you'd like to plug to the flaming nerds who listen to our podcast?
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, if they want to go to cosmicshambles.com, I've had a lot of nice times doing a new series called Tips for Existence, and I've got an episode with Neil Gaiman which is coming up, which is a lot of fun, and Tim Minchin and Andrian and Francesca Stavrakopoulou, who, if you've not had on this, you should, who's a great atheist Bible scholar from the University of Exeter.
I haven't even read the Atheist Bible.
Do you know what? It's not that much shorter, it turns out. The footnotes kind of make it a lot clearer. And also, I do a series now called Uncanny Hour, which is me talking to people like Stuart Lee and Alan Moore and various others about some of my favourite kind of odd films. I mean, I suppose the folklore one that I've just done is about Derek Jarman's Jubilee, which of course has John Dee and Queen Elizabeth I coming into the kind of dystopian vision of a collapsed London, but also things like Death Line and John Carpenter movies. So that they're all over at cosmicshambles.com.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you very much.
Keen-eared listeners might have noticed a couple of references to this episode being somewhat freewheeling, but I think you can't really tell in the edit.
No, I think it's like Robin didn't really know how ramshackle we normally are. And if anything, he brought a slickness and cohesion of thought that has never been there.
That said, our Patreons are in for a treat because we're going to upload a mega chunkulous extra from the outtakes of this recording.
I think it's going to be longer than the episode.
So if you want to hear all that, it's patreon.com/lawmenpod.
We will have to cut the bits where I slandered a Saturday night TV host.
Thinking of folkloric films, the film The Shout, based on a short story by Robert Graves with Alan Bates and Susanna York and John Hurt. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-mm.
No.
That's a really great, for folklore, it's about Alan Bates is someone who is in, he's in an asylum, and his thing is he has learnt, I think it's in Australia, with one of the Aboriginal tribes that he spent time with, a shout that is so terrifying and so powerful, it will destroy your enemy.
Oh, well, that sounds annoying.
It is. Just when you think we've got over the whistling.
Yeah, even worse.
We just have to take out two of his front teeth. Turned out he can't whistle anymore. Oh, he can shout, can he? You didn't mention his other superpower.
Wow.
And then even at night, he's got the snore, which can drive people to insanity.
What a trilogy of films.
Well, the great thing is those second two haven't been made, so I think we can. I think it's a three-way on this, isn't it, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, definitely. This is copyrighted now by being on the podcast.
Yep, yep. We just have to print the podcast out and post it to ourselves, and then in comes the money.